Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This week I'll be chatting with author George Mallinckrodt. George wrote a book called Getting Away with Murder. That book was a two-year project that he started in September of 2012 in frustration over the many dead ends he encountered while trying to get Darren Rainey justice. And we'll find out more about the very sad, unfortunate story of Darren Rainey and actually the entire criminal injustice system of the United States. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with author George Mallinckrodt. George Mallinckrodt, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Well, George, before we get into the substance of the interview, tell my listeners about yourself.
Well, I worked for nearly 3 years as a psychotherapist in a Florida State Prison psychiatric ward. It was called the Dade Correctional Institution. Inmates on my caseload were tormented, taunted, and beaten by correctional officers. I tried to make a difference. In fact, in a morning meeting after one of my patients was beaten, I suggested that we needed to change the situation with regard to the correctional officers that had taken this man into a hallway where there were no cameras, cuffed him behind his back, threw him to the floor, and just really started to kick the crap out of him. I was met with dead silence. Nobody wanted to talk about it. And in spite of the fact that my coworker was an eyewitness to this event, every suggestion, I guess you could say, was met with silence. I said, listen, you know, these guards committed an assault on a patient. That's a crime. Dead silence. When guards do this to our patients, they sabotage our cases. Dead silence. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Finally, the head of the psychiatric unit looked over at me and she said, well, Mr. Mallinckrodt, if you're having concerns, you should put it in writing. So that really ended up going nowhere, but I managed to get a meeting with the warden. His name was Jerry Cummings, and we sat down face to face. We had about a half an hour discussion about the abuses that were happening in this psychiatric unit. And a number of correctional officers just really got their jollies by antagonizing and instigating our patients into self-defeating behaviors. I remember one instance, a particularly severely mentally ill patient was visited on a regular basis, almost every day at shift change, by a sergeant who would get him so riled up that he would bang his head against the window of the cell door for an hour or more, and he would yell and scream. And the same sergeant went to the other side of the unit and did something similar to another man who would then go on for hours in a similar manner. So this was just a game for these guards to antagonize inmates. And I told the warden about this example and many others, and he instructed me to do incident reports as I heard of abuse from around the unit. once it was out that I was the go-to guy for inmate abuse, it seemed like every counseling session I had with my patients was all about abuse that they had not only seen in the unit, but abuse that they had seen around the state, because many of these guys came from North Florida, Central Florida, and the Dade Correctional Institution is located in South Florida, in Florida City. So I was hearing things I at first couldn't believe, but given that a patient in my own unit was beaten, it didn't take much for me to start to get on board. And as we found out later on in Miami Herald stories that were published about 2 years later, abuse was rampant throughout the state of Florida. And there have been so far over 20 suspicious deaths and very little accountability. In fact, last week I participated in a protest rally at State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle's office with regard to Darren Rainey. I'll get into the details in a second.
Right.
He was, he was scalded to death 4 years ago.
Wow.
And there had been no charges brought against the officers. The autopsy report finally came out about about 6 months ago, and we've only gotten the leaked version, which called his death accidental. And there's no way that his death was accidental. These guards had used this specially rigged shower treatment where the water was in excess of 180 degrees to essentially torture patients in the unit. And they had tortured four other severely mentally ill men before they killed Darren Rainey. And so on the four-year anniversary, we held the rally. That's June 23rd. And we got pretty good press coverage. The point we wanted to make in the rally was that we have not forgotten this mentally ill man who was essentially murdered. And so this is what I'm trying to do in his case, but in a more general way as a psychotherapist, I'm looking at ending the mass incarceration of the severely mentally ill.
Well, it's a huge problem, the percentage of prisoners that are in, incarcerated right now. Was it like something like 1 in 3 prisoners have mental illness?
Well, in terms of more general mental illness, it's closer to 60%.
Oh.
But for the severely mentally ill, that's anywhere from 17 to 20%. So about 1 in 5 of every inmate in prison or jail is severely mentally ill. And in our country right now, we criminalize mental illness. And these people, many of these people are in prison for no more than a manifestation of their psychiatric diagnoses.
Wow.
In other words, I've seen where as much as 40% of all homeless people are severely mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are out on the streets and they're desperate, and sometimes they'll open a car and they'll sleep overnight in a car and they'll get arrested for that. One man in Florida took 98 cents from an ashtray in a car, and he was arrested for that. So instead of providing treatment, we end up warehousing the severely mentally ill in prison. And then when they get in there, they're often abused, and the mental health treatment, if they get any, is substandard. Many end up in solitary.
Well, that's just a pathetic and pitiful state here in the United States of the people who are mentally ill like you said, are on the very lowest rungs of the social ladder. And you know, was it decades ago, so much abuse was found in institutions that instead of correcting the abuse, they closed the institutions. And we've seen a rise in mass shootings here in the United States, and most of it is because there is very little access to quality, free, or inexpensive mental health treatment here in the United States.
You're absolutely right, Cindy. When we closed psychiatric institutions because there was wholesale abuse and problems, politicians and our leaders were supposed to fund community mental health treatment centers, and they didn't. So these men and women were basically dumped on the streets where they found their way into the criminal justice system. And as for the rash of mass murders and shootings, these people that commit these crimes are often severely mentally ill. And my point here is, and this needs to be made, generally speaking, the incidence of violence among the severely mentally ill is no more than the general population. It's just that these shootings are so sensationalized, right, that people assume that the severely mentally ill are a very violent population, and that's just not so. My point as a psychotherapist is that since we don't have programs of early intervention in our communities and school systems, these types of people are often derailed by their mental illness. They are not treated, they worsen, and they're actually, the longer somebody goes without treatment, the poorer the outcome will be. So one of my objectives is to encourage our legislators and community leaders to fund not only mental health treatment facilities in our communities, but also programs of early intervention in our school systems. And keep in mind that 50% of all adults who suffer from lifelong mental illness had symptoms by the age of 14. 75% had symptoms by the age of 24. This is a vastly underserved population. And coincidentally, I worked in a middle school setting for an agency that provided services to students who were psychiatrically compromised. I worked with a 12-year-old girl who had been on medication for 3 years for hearing voices. She was diagnosed schizophrenic.
Wow.
Before I got that job, I wasn't even aware that children that young could suffer from that degree of mental illness. Some of the other children on my caseload were bipolar, major depressive disorder. I had cutters, bulimics, anorexics. So in other words, unless we get to these children early and make a difference with not only counseling, but psychotherapeutic medication as well, they will suffer in silence because there is a huge stigma attached to mental illness. And just imagine, if you will, a young child who starts to hear voices. What's the likelihood that they're going to come forward? It's very minimal. So they suffer for years, and they go untreated, and often the severely mentally ill don't even graduate from high school. So they end up out on the streets, and this is where they look to street drugs for relief from their symptoms. And then quite often they fall in with a, a bad crowd, and before you know it, they're caught up in the revolving door of the criminal justice system.
Let's talk about the Darren Rainey case. What was he arrested for? Why was he in prison?
He was serving a 2-year sentence for 2 grams of cocaine. And that raises another issue about addiction. Not only are we criminalizing mental illness, but we're criminalizing addiction as well. So both of these should be treated, but they're not, because we don't have facilities. So a man like Darren Rainey, instead of getting help for his addiction, is thrown into prison.
And then abused and ultimately murdered.
Exactly. And his case is not an isolated one. The mentally ill are more likely than men in the general population to be thrown into solitary. And that's contraindicated for the mentally ill. They're also more likely to be abused by guards and fellow inmates. So our ability to treat the mentally ill in prison is very substandard, and obviously that's not a great venue to treat mental illness. In my own psychiatric unit, I wasn't suffering from mental illness, but every time I walked in there, I felt a little depressed. You can imagine somebody who is suffering from mental illness, how that must have seemed on a daily basis. And then the other thing that happened in my unit is these men were locked down 24/7. They only came out for counseling with me, medical, and recreation if they took advantage of it.
Well, and solitary or other confinement, it could seriously mess up a mentally healthy person.
That's exactly right. And I can tell you that many people are leaving prison worse off than when they went in. And the vast majority of people in prison will be released. They'll be released into our communities. And we as individuals have to take responsibility for this situation, because we're the ones electing leaders who turn a blind eye to this problem.
It's just so tragic. So tell about the incident. You did mention that Darren Rainey was scalded, but talk about that more. Paint the picture about how sadistic. It seems like the wrong people are behind the bars.
Yeah, that's right, Cindy. He was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and he was smearing his feces around his cell. And this is something that, as a mental health professional working in that venue, we had seen a lot of that. That was not uncommon. And the guards, however, decided to make an example of him, teach him a lesson. I don't know what their rationale was exactly, but they took him and they locked him into a specially rigged shower where he had no control over the water temperature. And they blasted him with only hot water. And I know from working there that you could not hold your hand under the hot water for more than a split second before it would start to burn you.
Right.
So even though he was not in the direct spray of the shower, the room no doubt heated up to an intolerable temperature, and he was heard by fellow patients begging to be let out. He kept saying, "I won't do it no more. Let me out. Please let me out. I won't do it no more." And what he was referring to was what he was doing with his feces.
Right.
And it was sometime past an hour of being in there that a patient heard him just fall to the floor. He just collapsed. And sometime later, the guards came back to find him face up, covering the drain, and 90% of his skin had peeled off.
Oh my God.
And his death was originally classified as an in-custody death from natural causes.
Wow.
And this would have gone completely under the radar and unnoticed if it were not for one of his fellow patients by the name of Harold Hempstead, who reached out to the Miami Herald a little over 2 years ago and gave an account of what he had witnessed in that unit. And little did Harold know, I had taken an interest in Darren Rainey's case because a coworker called me 2 days after it happened with a frantic phone call, and she said, "They killed him." And the book I wrote, Getting Away with Murder, starts with those three words. And so I embarked on my own journey to get Darren Rainey justice. I met face-to-face with FBI agents who passed on an investigation, and I took a lot of other measures, including filing a complaint with the Department of Justice. But until that Miami Herald story, that first one came out, no one really knew about Darren Rainey. And I immediately stepped forward publicly in the second story and blew the whistle on my unit. And once that got out into the public domain, many other people within the Florida Department of Corrections contacted Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown and told them about all these other suspicious deaths throughout Florida and the brutality and this cover-up mentality. So the first half dozen stories focused on my unit, and then it was like wildfire. The Miami Herald has published well over 120 articles to date.
Wow.
On this issue.
Wow, that's very unusual.
Yeah, I mean, the Miami Herald is super committed to this. In fact, they have sued the Department of Corrections for unredacted documents regarding the over 20 suspicious deaths. So this is a newspaper that's dedicated to getting to the truth. And I applaud the Miami Herald. I can't tell you how much respect I have for Julie Brown and all the other reporters who have contributed stories to this issue in Florida. But I'd like your listeners to know that this is not isolated just to Florida.
Right.
We've heard horrific stories coming out of Rikers Island.
Right.
Khalif Browder in his story, and this is happening nationwide. And from what I understand from people who contact me around the United States, I'd have to say that the top five most brutal prison systems are, in no particular order, California,
right,
Texas, Florida, New York, and Arizona. I'm just hearing horrible things out of all these states.
Well, what about the Supermax prisons? These are, they're torture facilities, and the abuse and the torture that happens is, the United States gets on its high horse and goes around the world and says, this is a brutal dictatorship, that's a brutal dictatorship. We have to bring democracy to that country. We have to bring freedom and democracy to another country. When the United States, by numbers and by percentage, incarcerate and brutally treat more people than anybody else in the world.
Yeah, that's right, Cindy. And we need to take care of our own business and clean our own house first before we go pointing fingers overseas. The Supermax prisons are a horrible proposition because they often isolate men for years. And these are our situations that we would figure that would happen in third world countries, and yet it's happening here in the United States. These inmates really don't have a lot of power when you get right down to it. For example, when a guard tells an inmate, cuff up, they've got to follow that command. And once they're cuffed, they're at the mercy of these guards. And if they don't cuff up, then they call four or five other guards and they take the man down with brute force. So these inmates, you know, and particularly in my unit, there were several, I would say, lightweight inmates, maybe weighed less than 140 pounds, who were manhandled by guards to the point where they were thrown to the floor. And I know two of them had gashes opened in their foreheads that required stitches. So this is just, I would have to say, pretty epidemic, and it's systemic abuse across the entire nation. Some states are a little bit better than others, but guards that look to abuse inmates are on a power trip. Maybe they have a maturity of a 12-year-old schoolyard bully. And we've got to turn this around, because the bottom line is, if we treat inmates, or if we treat anybody with respect, we're going to get respect back. And in Florida, in this culture of brutality, it's thought that the only way to maintain order is through violence. And violence just creates more violence. And we've had a number of prison riots lately in Florida. And our Secretary of the Department of Corrections, Julie Jones, likes to point out that there's not enough funding for staffing and staff levels are low, so on and so forth. But she never points to the culture of brutality and disrespect as a reason why these men riot.
Well, here in California in 2014, I ran for governor against Jerry Brown, and one of the problems, you know, Jerry Brown is in the back pocket of the private prisons and the prison industrial complex, but one of the problems is how powerful the prison guard unions are.
Yes, I've heard that California has the most powerful, but these unions for guards, it seems like a great portion of their time is spent defending the brutality
right.
of guards.
Right.
You know, they're not doing themselves any favors. And I got to tell you, there are a lot of terrific correctional professionals out there. The problem is they will never step forward against their own because they're afraid of retaliation.
Well, just and like the police, right? Just like
exactly.
Like, right, exactly. So, George, this has been a wonderful interview, and it's flown by. Tell my listeners about SPAN. I mean, these stories, especially the one about Darren Rainey, personally makes me want to cry. But realizing that it is widespread and, you know, his isn't an isolated incident, enrages me. So tell about SPAN, and what can my listeners and I do to help this issue?
Yes, SPAN is Stop Prison Abuse Now. They have a Facebook presence, so go on Facebook and look up SPAN. Something else you can do too is go to my website, and the easiest way to get there is gettingawaywithmurder.org. So that's easy to remember, gettingawaywithmurder.org. And as individuals, like I said before, we've got to elect officials that focus on the causes of mental illness and doing something about that. And unless we get officials that are sympathetic, nothing's going to change. This problem is going to persist.
Well, George Mallinckrodt, author of Getting Away with Murder, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I will put all those links so I'll share them with my listeners and the wider audience.
Terrific. Thanks for having me on, Cindy.
Well, thank you. Have a good weekend.
Okay, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired. And I just want to say that this show really affected me more than usual, and to really seek justice and to expose injustice is so important. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank George Mallinckrodt for his work and for making himself available to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.